This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Joining us now, Mr. Christopher Butler. So, Mr. Butler, what do you do for our wonderful non-existent government, sir?
Well, I'm an electronics technician, and I work on Navy radar systems for the Norfolk Ship Support Activity.
And today you are?
I am furloughed. Actually, I go in this morning to conduct an orderly shutdown of the government.
Non-essential federal worker Chris Butler, one of 800,000 federal workers with a day off without pay today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Breaking news, it is now midnight. The U.S. government has officially shut down.
The old fiscal year has officially ended. A new one has begun without funding for much of the government.
As of right now, in the process of shutting down.
Employees will be limited to doing work related to the shutdown.
Hundreds of thousands of federal workers will go on unpaid leave for the duration.
Nobody gets along. They're fighting with each other constantly.
We're just starting to get back on our feet. It'll just really damage our economy.
Shut it down!
It's all right if you love me.
All the Senate has to do is say yes.
It's all right if you don't.
We'll not go to conference with a gun to our head.
I'm not afraid of you running away, honey. I get the feeling you owe.
What they're doing is a luxury our country cannot afford.
There is no good thing going to come out of it.
Other people are going to get hurt.
America, folks, I believe has something in common with Somalia or the Democratic Republic of Congo, nations without functioning governments. And while those tragic places in the world have been victims of violence, war, and poverty, the government-free condition of the United States is completely self-inflicted. The USA has shut down its own government over a disagreement that couldn't be resolved by midnight last night. Government is now engaged in what our good friend Christopher Butler, you heard him there, one of the 800,000 furloughed federal employees, told us was a controlled shutdown. We'll hear more from Mr. Butler a little later this hour. We'll find out what he thinks of being designated a non-essential employee. I mean, what is that like? We've done that twice where I work, right here at WNYC, once during the 9/11 attacks, and a second time was last year during a hurricane, Hurricane Sandy. We had to designate who was essential, who was non-essential. They're doing this to themselves in Washington. Speaking of hurricanes, NOAA just tweeted, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just tweeted, we're sorry, this account will not be actively managed during the federal government shutdown. Don't expect any tweets from NOAA on impending storms. Well, Mr. Butler, our good friend, is actually headed into work today to begin that controlled government shutdown. Control or self-control is not what I would call what's going on between the White House and Capitol Hill. The dispute over the Affordable Care Act has become a deeper argument over how Congress should function or whether it functions at all. Joining us live from Capitol Hill is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, we knew this day would come, or did we?
Well, we had a pretty good idea. There were several off-ramps built into this process all along, John. There were off-ramps up until 11:59 last night, but members of Congress and the leadership chose not to take them, so here we are.
What's going to happen today? What do we see unfolding over the next 8 to 10 hours?
You see standoff. What this is about now, look, government shutdowns are important to federal employees, of course, who are furloughed, who aren't getting paid, who can't go to work.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, of course, it is. However, in context, a government shutdown is primarily a political event, especially viewed in context of something that might happen later, like the debt limit, which is coming up. And so what you're going to see today, I'm sorry to say, is a lot of blame. Once a government shutdown happens, it becomes really important to make sure the other guy gets blamed for it. And to the extent that you see members of Congress, leaders on either side, going in front of cameras or on radio mics to talk about shutdown, it's important that they're not blamed for it, that it's the other guy's shutdown. So get ready for that. Hey, I'll give you an example. How about Minority Leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, just last night, as the clock ticked just minutes before a shutdown off the House floor. Listen to Nancy Pelosi.
You do not use the threat of shutting down government to try to advance your policy agenda. That's just not the way it works. And that's what is called irresponsible. And that is why this is the Tea Party government shutdown.
And that's the issue here. This is a debate about how government should function. And this use of the continuing resolution, Pelosi's had it up to here with that.
She has. And so then the question starts to become, if this is a political event, which it is, proximal risks of a shutdown. One side gets blamed. The polling says Republicans get blamed for this, for being the cause of the shutdown. Okay, but what about later on? There's no election tomorrow. The election is next November. The question becomes, all right, Republicans, you might be aware that you're going to get blamed now, but do you really think this hurts you in 2014? This is interesting. I want to play a couple guys here real quick. Listen to Lindsey Graham, who we all know from South Carolina,
sure,
sort of talking about the interplay between the Affordable Care Act and a shutdown.
It depends on how this plays out in the average person's mind. We won't get punished for trying to fight the good fight against a bad idea. If it turns out to be a good idea, then we'll be in trouble.
And that's where the White House wins. I mean, the ACA goes into effect today. There's going to be some evidence on that test that Lindsey Graham is talking about in a very few weeks.
The White House is worried, John, that with inevitable enrollment glitches and getting a giant bureaucracy, a big act like the Affordable Care Act up and running, that there will be glitches. They know Republicans are poised to capitalize on every single one. Republicans, on the other hand, are worried that if it goes well, hey, this is a giant entitlement. This is benefits. People like benefits. People who weren't getting coverage like getting coverage. And all of the glitches and computer problems and headaches that they experience in October 1st of 2013 will be forgotten by Election Day. And as Lindsey Graham says, nothing succeeds like success. Both sides are worried about the success or failure depending on where they sit on this.
It's just shocking we're back to 1995. And I feel like talking to Monica Lewinsky. I mean, it's just such a deja vu situation here. When could this be over, if at all?
John, we really don't have any indication of that. We are in a stalemate. Leaving Capitol Hill at about 1 a.m. this morning, I saw some senior staffers on the steps, and I said, guys, game plan, what's next? Body language, John, hands in pockets. These were Democrats saying, we got nothing. Look, the clean CR, the continuing resolution, remains the pending business in the House. Harry Reid's not kidding. John Boehner has to pass that. We're not going to conference. We're not doing any gimmicks. That's the one that we know has the votes. He can pass it, and so we're sitting here.
From Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
Despite the government shutdown, it's here, the Affordable Care Act. It's day one of major pieces of the long-contested health care law, officially up and running today, including the most important ways that the uninsured can become insurance consumers through the federal marketplaces. Joining us now is Myra Alvarez, Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome to the program, Myra.
Thank you for having me, John.
My first question is, though, I guess somehow you were informed that you are an essential federal employee?
Right. Those of us that are working on the marketplace, many of us are here trying to wrap things up, preparing for the shutdown. Others are using this time to ensure that we're educating the American people about this opportunity for coverage, are able to look at their options and begin the process for enrollment and coverage.
Now, I have to say, I mean, and I want to ask you about some of the specifics that you're really concerned about. But, you know, some people are packing boxes and other people are opening boxes. This is not the way you imagined the day one of the Affordable Care Act would be, right, Myra?
I mean, we are working under the circumstances that are in front of us. What's important to us is that the marketplace is open. We obviously, as an administration, are committed to working with Congress. But really, what's important to us is ensuring that the American people are aware that healthcare.gov is an open marketplace and that they are able to right now go onto that website, call the call center, go to an in-person assister, and get the assistance they need to enroll in coverage.
No, I can hear a little bit of frustration there. Let's move on, though. Let's talk about who needs to get the message most today and who are the greatest challenges to receiving the information they need to go from uninsured to insured, from your perspective.
Sure. Well, you know, as I'm sure you know and are well aware of, there's a varying degree of awareness of the marketplace in the public, and we are aware that health insurance is not the easiest thing to understand, but it's exactly what the marketplace intends to do for the American people. You know, oftentimes people are frustrated with the application process, or they're not aware of what benefits are covered, or they get confused or are turned away because of a pre-existing condition. Those are the very challenges that the marketplace addresses. It's a simpler way to purchase health insurance. all in one place for consumers. With one application, they can find and compare their options, they can see if they qualify for lower costs, and most importantly, they can pick the coverage that best meets their needs and budget. And that's what we're trying to give the American people, a simpler way to purchase health insurance, because all of us, you know, we're one diagnosis, one car accident away from a lifetime of hurt, and that health insurance is going to provide us the security and peace of mind that we need to lead healthy lives.
Well, you're speaking to the American people. Speak to one American person, if you could. Say I'm a Latino, uninsured individual who, you know, lives fairly close to the poverty line, and the thing that scares me the most, Myra, is a monthly bill of like $100 a month or whatever it's going to be. Insurance, no way. I'll just wait and go to the emergency room.
Definitely, absolutely. And what's important to keep in mind is that the concept of insurance is a foreign concept to many people. But what is essential for the American people to know is that health insurance is that security and that peace of mind. We all have bills to pay. We all have a job to keep, or our kids want to be successful in school. And you need to be healthy to be able to be the most productive person you can be. Health insurance helps ensure that health, that healthy living, whether it's seeking preventive services so that you're aware of your health status and you can get that cholesterol screening or that mammogram, or if it's actually seeking treatment for a chronic disease that you may have, like diabetes. What's important is that health insurance will allow us to lead those healthy lives. So for that, you know, Latino that's living near the poverty level and doesn't know what to do when it comes to health insurance, healthcare.gov will provide them the option to enroll in affordable coverage. We estimate that 6 out of 10 people that qualify for coverage will qualify for coverage that's less than $100. I mean, how many of us pay more for our cell phone bill? That's something that we want to make clear to people, that because of the marketplace, we're offering people a competitive environment where insurance companies compete for their business so that we can lower costs while giving them a high-quality product that covers the services they need. And more importantly, it's a process, it's a way of applying for coverage that's easier to understand. You know, when we buy things online, whether it's a television set or an airplane ticket or, you know, a purse, we're familiar with that online process. We know how to compare our options. We know how to sort things based on price or based on color. But when it comes to health insurance, that process isn't as easy. It's often a very thick packet. It's a small font. We get overwhelmed. We need to be just as informed and just as secure in our purchase of health insurance. And that's what the marketplace is going to provide us.
And if I need a face-to-face person to handhold me through the process, so what are my options?
So there's a great website, localhelp.healthcare.gov, and that provides people easy-to-understand information about the resources in their community. So at that website, they can put in their zip code or they can put in their city, and they'll have a list of in-person assistance sources in their community, whether that be the local library or their health center or a community center that's signed on to help people enroll in coverage. They'll have that information. In addition, if folks aren't comfortable with working online, they can also call our call center at 1-800-318-2596 and also ask those questions about where to seek help or actually ask questions about the application process itself.
Finally, and before we go, and that's a lot of information, and thank you so much for that, how disheartening is it to realize that as you're working there hard to try to get this up and running, that there's a whole group of people on the other side of town that really wants to completely shut you down?
You know, I think when it comes to healthcare and well-being, all of us, regardless of where we sit on that political spectrum, want to make sure our families are healthy. And it's talking to folks about what the marketplace will do for the health of the American people that we need to focus on. Take a step back from the politics and just really focus on the well-being of our communities. And if we can do that, we can be successful.
Myra Alvarez, Associate Director of the Office of Minority Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. They're up and running today. Myra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later on The Takeaway, two students remember the teacher who pushed them harder than they'd ever been pushed. Is there a tough teacher who maybe caused you some pain but changed your life?
This is Liz Adams. I'm calling from South Carolina. When I was in college, the professor used to call on me every day. It became a running joke. It also taught me to be prepared, to manage my time, and to think on my feet. At the time, it was incredibly hard, but I am so grateful now.
Listen to Liz Adams thinking on her feet there, calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much. Tell us about the teacher, the tough teacher, who changed your life.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The private business world does not get a day off today, especially the insurance business. This is a very busy, all-hands-on-deck day as the Affordable Care Act takes effect, government shutdown notwithstanding. We spoke with two representatives of the insurance business who are ready for this day. Gary Mizell is CEO of Western Health Advantage, a nonprofit and regional health insurance company in California, a small company, but a big player. Western specializes in coverage for small employers. And Ray Smithberger is the chief operating officer of individual and family plans for Cigna, one of the largest health insurance companies in the country with over 11 million customers. Cigna will be participating in the federal marketplaces in four states and in the Colorado market, which is a state-based exchange. Like politics, Smithberger told us, all health insurance is local.
Individual health insurance is a local buying decision. So in order to be competitive in these local markets, you need to act like a local company. And while we are a national carrier, we do have local capabilities that do allow us to create specific networks for hospitals and physicians within those markets, and also leverage a lot of the great tools that we offer to national employers.
Now, I'm actually an enrollee of Cigna through my union, AFTRA. Nothing's going to change for me on October 1st, is it?
No, the changes that are taking place on October 1st are for individual customers purchasing individual insurance.
Gary Mizell of Western Health Advantage, you're part of a much smaller company, maybe closer to that local scenario that Ray is describing. How does your world change on October 1st?
We're expecting a lot of folks to begin shopping or at least looking. Open enrollment runs for 6 months from October 1st through March 31st. So we expect a lot of people to start to look through the web-based enrollment system to see what their options are, to see whether or not they are subsidy eligible, and to just start the shopping experience. We don't expect a lot of folks are going to enroll the first day or two. In fact, we think folks are probably going to go back maybe five or six times to the web portal before they actually make that buying decision over the next, 6 months or so.
Now, the critics in Congress and this debate that's sometimes very difficult to understand going on in Congress suggests that the implications of the implementation and the creation of these exchanges and marketplaces is going to increase prices across the board. Do you see a price increase, a premium increase for customers such as myself and others over the next 18 months as a result of what's going on with the Affordable Care Act? Ray?
Yeah, so you'll see a variety. You'll see for some individuals, prices will increase, and for others, prices will decrease. It depends on such factors as age and possibly what type of insurance you've purchased today. So depending on the state in which you live and the type of benefit that you select, it's quite possible to see both extremes occurring.
And Gary, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with everything Ray said. The big difference here is while the underlying core premium may go up a bit, when you layer on top the subsidies that millions of folks across the country will be eligible to receive, the net cost of their monthly premium will probably go down for a whole lot of folks because of the effect of those government subsidies. So I think you have to look at it post-subsidy premium rather than pre-subsidy premium.
But then, Gary, you're just going to jack up the prices for people who are already using Western Health Advantage and can't go anywhere, right?
No, we're not, because we're a community-rated plan, so we rate based on the health status of the population in the communities we serve, and it is age-banded. Ray is correct. There is an age cell for every age between the age of 18 and 64. So every age, each of us will age into a new rate cell. So there's going to be gradual increases in premium as one gets older. But other than that, I think it's going to be normal underlying healthcare trends. I don't think that anyone expects the ACA to cause dramatic price decreases. The hope is that it's going to bend the cost curve downward so that the future increases of healthcare aren't at the levels that we've seen for the past two decades.
Gary Mizell is CEO of Western Health Advantage out in California. Ray Smithberger, so if my premium takes a big jump in the next year, it's going to be only because of some sort of basic trend in the industry based on my age, not because Cigna really sees an advantage of getting more revenue from people who can't afford really to move anywhere else, like, you know, someone in his 50s with a family of five.
So on individual premiums, there are many factors that could play into what sets your premium. Gary had mentioned, you know, the age factors. With the 2014 new policies, there was also, in some states, an increase in benefit levels. You may, as an individual, also decide to prefer the predictability of a copay plan over the possible flexibility of a higher deductible HSA-eligible plan. The other thing to keep in mind is that the rates that we set are actually approved by the states as well. So we go through a process in which we have to implement certain factors in our rating criteria and then review those with the states. So we're not arbitrarily setting rates in the insurance market. Those are actually regulated and reviewed by state and federal agencies to ensure compliance.
Now, to both of you, I don't want you to wade into politics at all, but just in general, you've done all this work, and you're ready for what's happening this week. I mean, based on all of that, does it make any sense to delay this for a year? Is that just another headache, or would you go along with that? Ray and then Gary.
We've made a commitment across the industry to supporting changes effective on 10-1.
Gary Mizell, what do you say?
I personally think it would be a travesty if we didn't move forward and just see how this works. California is ready to go. We're going to proceed regardless of what happens at the federal level.
Gary Mizell, CEO of Western Health Advantage, and Ray Smithberger, General Manager of Individual and Family Plans for Cigna Insurance. Thanks to you both, guys.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Rejoining our friend Chris Butler now, who we met at the top of the program. Chris Butler is an electronics technician for the U.S. Navy and the vice president of the IFPTE, the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. Christopher, what were you planning to do today if you weren't going in to do an orderly shutdown? What was your basically on your to-do list?
On my to-do list was pretty much going in and do my normal job, which I'm involved in employee representation, not just for grievances, but for just the day-to-day business of the command. Today would have been a department head meeting, which I would have been a part of, and been able to weigh in on the direction the command is taking and the executive decisions of the command.
A lot of electronics there in the Navy, right?
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of technicians that have to be up to speed to keep that stuff in tip-top shape for the U.S. government.
Yes, our facility is actually like the fire department for the Navy. If the Navy cannot fix a problem on their ships while they are deployed, we dispatch one of our technicians and they go out and assist them in correcting the problem.
Okay, so you're like the fire department for the Navy. That sounds a lot more important to me than what Eric Cantor is going to be doing today on Capitol Hill. Am I nuts?
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good assessment, seeing how they really haven't been doing much of anything up there on the Hill. Congressional approval right now is hovering around 10% because they just aren't doing their jobs.
Eric Cantor is going to call a meeting. Harry Reid is not going to show up. Maybe he will show up. Who knows? But there'll be some news conferences, there'll be some photo ops, and at the end of the day, the government will either be operating, which, of course, it should have been always, or it won't be operating. That seems to me a paltry excuse for a paycheck compared to fire department for the Navy.
I would tend to agree with you. We don't just do the fire department for the Navy thing. Our command also is responsible for the government oversight for all work done in the private shipyards in the local area here in the southeastern Virginia. And, of course, there's a government shipyard here, Norfolk Naval Shipyard, but about 50% of the work is contracted out to the private shipyards. And we administer the contract, we provide the oversight, make sure the Navy's getting what they're paying for.
Well, Chris, you know, you don't have to convince me. You're doing real work here. You're definitely doing real work here. What about the fact that this is all about the Affordable Care Act? What's your view on that?
Well, I have a sister who is in her 60s who has insurance today because of the Affordable Care Act. And I think it's a horrible thing for the House to hold the Affordable Care Act hostage when it is going to provide health care for millions and millions of Americans.
All right. What's your first bill that you're going to miss here, Chris?
It's hard to say. I have 33 years, so I do have some savings. I'm going to be dipping into savings. But when you're not bringing in the paycheck that you're used to getting, especially myself, I'm a single parent. I'm a widower, and I have two children in college. So life was tough already with two kids in college, let alone suffering a reduction in pay. So it means I'll have to dip into some savings. But for a lot of people where I work at, they just are not as well established as I am, and they're the ones that are really impacted very severely.
Chris Butler, electronics technician for the U.S. Navy and vice president of the IFPTE. That's the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers, local number one. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And over the weekend, armed members of the terrorist group Boko Haram are believed to have killed more than 40 students at a college campus in Nigeria. It's the latest attack from the Islamic group Boko Haram, whose mission is to establish an Islamic state in northern Nigeria. The massacre also comes on the heels of the four-day siege at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya, by the Somali terror group Al-Shabaab, now allied with Al-Qaeda. Those attacks left at least 60 people dead and many more injured. David Cook, associate professor of religious studies at Rice University, has written about Islamic extremism in Africa and joins me from Houston. Professor Cook, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
First of all, I know enough Arabic to know that haram means forbidden. What does Boko Haram mean? Would people understand that it's a particular message?
Yeah, it's an acronym in Hausa, basically referring to Western-style education.
And so the targeting of a college campus in Nigeria is very specific to their message.
It is. And they have frequently attacked university students or high school students with various different massacres over the last 4 years.
Do you see in any sense the activity of Boko Haram last weekend linked to what happened in Kenya, in the sense that small groups in Africa are trying to get a higher profile, a higher degree of visibility?
No, I wouldn't say that Boko Haram is linked to the Westgate massacre. I would say that it's part of a trajectory of movement on the part of Boko to demonstrate that it is still a viable player in northeastern Nigeria. Over the summer, the Nigerian army has repeatedly leveled attacks against it and has demonstrated a level of overconfidence as far as the results go that is precluded by this most recent massacre.
Does Boko Haram have any aspirations to ally itself with Al-Qaeda, become a part of the franchise arrangement there with Al-Qaeda, as Al-Shabaab has done?
It has mentioned things like that, and that's an issue that intelligence people oftentimes discuss. I personally do not believe that Boko actually has connections with Al-Qaeda. I think that it's a localized radical Islamic group that at most has connections with other radical groups in West Africa rather than the Al-Qaeda worldwide.
In terms of the average Nigerian who understands that Boko Haram is a threat, how terrified are they of this kind of attack being wreaked upon them in their beds, whether they're university students or not?
I would say quite terrified. I would say quite terrified. Nigerians have gotten a lot more serious about Boko Haram since 2 years ago when it began using suicide attacks mainly against Christian and governmental targets. Those proceeded until October of last year when the army began to hem it into northeastern Nigeria. And so one has to say right now that Boko's operations are fairly limited to northeastern Nigeria, but it still maintains the ability to cast terror over the entire country.
Do you foresee that this is the end of a chapter and the beginning of possibly a new chapter, in that Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and other groups in the region might actually target Westerners in their own countries outside of Nigeria and Kenya and actually attempt something even more brazen?
Boko Haram has demonstrated the ability and willingness to attack Westerners, but mostly those that just happen to be travelers or are serving the locals in medical or educational methods. And for the most part, those people have simply left northern Nigeria. It's simply too dangerous today. As far as Somalia goes, I think that the Somalians do have to carry out more operations in Kenya in order to maintain their high profile. For their point of view, the Westgate operation was a huge success. It gained them a great deal of notoriety and placed their leader Godon on the map, where previously he was just one of a number of different players.
Which suggests there might be other attacks in the works to keep that momentum going. David Cook, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Cook is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University. He joined me from Houston. An emotional journey now. So many of us have had the experience of a great teacher, and when they're gone, there's the pang of wondering, did I make sure to tell that teacher how much they meant to me?
I came back with my viola that I had stopped playing 25 years earlier, and when I walked in for that rehearsal, we were greeted literally by 40 years worth of students. Mm-hmm.
That's veteran journalist Joanne Lippman talking about the experience of playing in the Memorial Concert in February of 2010. You're hearing it there. For Jerry Kupchinski, Mr. K, a legendary string and orchestra teacher of young people in New Jersey. He was also the toughest and most uncompromising, stingy with praise teacher they ever had. Joanne Lippman's recollections of her viola teacher in the New York Times produced such an outpouring of responses from hundreds of loyal students that Lippman and award-winning concert violinist Melanie Kupchinski, Jerry's daughter, collaborated on a book, Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. Melanie described what it was like as a little girl to receive her dad's gift every day of her life.
My dad was tough as a teacher and as a father. He was strict. He was a disciplinarian. He didn't take any nonsense. He made me work really hard at my instrument, and also he demanded a lot of me at home. And yet, as strict and demanding as he was also equally affectionate and loving and supportive of me, and I feel that that combination gave me a really great start in life, and I'm eternally grateful to him.
This is the guy, because he was so hard on me and hard on all of his students, he held you to this higher standard, and the way that he spoke to us, it was transferring the responsibility to you. He never said, oh, you're great, you're talented. I never heard him use the word talent, but what he would do is commend you for working hard.
Let me read you something. This is about you, Melanie. When you were at a very important point in your life, where the question was, do you keep on with music or do you pursue other possibilities? Because your test scores were so spectacular, and you write here in the book, what about people who aren't as sure of their dreams? Your dad had little respect for those who don't have the guts to be certain the way he was, you write. He doesn't have the patience for kids who are confused by the variety of choices, who resist the deep, difficult work of becoming excellent in favor of flitting from thing to thing, a jack of all trades and a master of none. My dad never mentioned the aspirations of his own that he may have abandoned in pursuit of his career, though he used to write poetry and perhaps would have been a writer himself. I only know that he is driven, focused, and single-minded, his goal to be the best music teacher it is possible to be. Melanie, how do you think he came to that?
Well, I think that when he got out of Ukraine and away from the war and the famine and everything that he had gone through, and he came to this country with pretty much basically nothing, he was so fortunate to run up against a music professor who took him under his wing and to have this opportunity to go to college. And while we were researching the book, I found all the report cards he had ever received all the way back through kindergarten that he had taken with him from Ukraine. And it dawned on me how important education was to my father. It was just the most important thing ever.
He spent his formative years, we later learned, but he never spoke of it, running from the Russians, the Germans, the Poles. things that he never talked about that Melanie and I did a massive amount of research on.
Why he was so terrified of the communists, something that you grew up with, Melanie, but the details of which only come out in this book.
Right. I knew some of the story, but he never talked about it and answered my questions in the briefest possible way. And all of this came to light pretty much after he had passed away.
I mean, the other narrative that goes through this book is the disappearance of your sister, Stephanie. And in many ways, the journey of this book is a journey to see a man who was so intimidating and so unbelievably strong and single-minded, to see him so unbelievably vulnerable in these details you've unearthed about him growing up and his reaction to the loss of his daughter. What is it like to see someone that vulnerable who's been so strong for all of your life, Melanie?
Well, it was a big test for all of us, and it was unbelievably difficult. It's something that anybody would find difficult, but I think for my dad, it came after so much other things, so many other things that had happened to him, that it was almost insurmountable. But I feel that he and I shored each other up through that, and his students and his music came to the rescue for him and helped us. And music played a big role for me in helping me get through all the events that happened.
And I'll let people read the precise details in the book, but one of the people who came to the rescue was Joanne Lippman, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
That was when Mr. K re-entered my life after I had been out of touch for many years. And Melanie and I, in fact, had been out of touch for many years. And I received a phone call at the Wall Street Journal, where I was at that time a reporter, from Mr. K saying, "My daughter is missing. Can you help me?" I was able to put him in touch, you know, with various media outlets so that they could get the word out about what had happened. And the focus, the resilience, the discipline, it was like every single thing that Mr. K had ever taught us, they both put into play in the most unbelievably major way.
Melanie, you know, you've benefited probably more than anyone from being Jerry's daughter, but what does this say about teaching and praise? And, you know, maybe it shouldn't be the case that a teacher this tough is so unusual in our time. What's the lesson there?
Well, I think that we're finding more and more that kids respond well to being held to a high standard.
Hard work is always a tough lesson. And Joanne, in your case, your toughness as a journalist maybe comes from Jerry?
Without question. And I spoke to so many of his students and I said, you know, why was it where all these people came back? And people were using the same phrases. They said, he taught us resilience. He taught us the ability to persevere. When people say no to you, the ability to say, yeah, I'm going to keep going. One of the other things that one of his students said that I thought was such a smart lesson was he taught us how to fail and how to pick ourselves up again. And I thought that was such a smart comment. Everybody needs to understand that to be able to kind of persevere in life.
I think for me, too, that was a very valuable lesson. I didn't just walk in and get a job in the Chicago Symphony. I took many auditions, and it was hard to keep going after a while that you think, you know, if I'm not going to be able to do this easily. But with my father behind me and all those lessons of picking myself up and trying again, I was able to earn myself a really wonderful job that I love.
And we're very glad you did. Melanie Kupchinski is a violinist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, 21-time Grammy winner and co-author of the book Strings Attached, with Joanne Lippman, former editor-in-chief, journalist, and co-author of Strings Attached. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thank you, John.
And here's Melanie at age 8 performing Concertino for Violin. The piece was composed by Philip Gordon, and here Melanie performs it with the East Brunswick Junior High School Orchestra in Atlantic City at a National Convention of Music Teachers in February of 1970. Jerry Kupchinski, the conductor.
So at the end of the hour and at the end of the day, is there any argument for delaying the implementation of the Affordable Care Act or stopping the Health Care Reform Act in midstream in any way? Would there be any benefit to allowing Navy electricians like we talked to earlier this hour and park rangers to return to work while telling the people who are anxious to get health insurance under the ACA marketplaces to wait a year? Ovik Roy and Ezekiel Emanuel join us now. Ovik Roy is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ezekiel Emanuel is a former Obama administration advisor on health care. Currently, he serves as the chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to both of you.
How are you?
Thank you.
Ezekiel, let's begin with you. What would be so bad about delaying the ACA for a year?
Well, the entire country is ready and geared up. The insurance companies are ready and geared up. The health systems are ready and geared up. And I think we're set to go. And I think the last offer was about the stupidest offer I could imagine. Delay the individual mandate. You cannot have an insurance marketplace that excludes pre-existing conditions without an individual mandate. So there's no real rationale for postponing it other than grandstanding and hot political rhetoric.
That's Ezekiel Emanuel. Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Delay, I mean, we've already talked with insurance companies who are going ahead with this. People are signing up. What is the point of delaying?
Well, let me first say that I have been outspoken in criticizing the Ted Cruz strategy of linking the continuing resolution and the government shutdown. I don't think that's the right idea. But I will say that a lot of the state exchange directors have asked for a year delay. So Kevin Counihan, who's the CEO of the Connecticut Exchange, has said, we've had so much trouble complying with all the HHS regulations, which come out every couple of weeks, and then we have to redesign our entire exchange based on that, that he's not comfortable that the exchange will be ready and up and running and have the security features necessary to ensure that the people who are signing up get the coverage they're supposed to get, that the subsidies they're eligible for or ineligible for are the ones that they're assigned. These are some of the problems. Privacy is another one. These are some of the problems the exchanges have. So it's not correct to say that the exchanges are ready to go. They could benefit from some extra time to get up and running.
But that's no different than a lot of the bluster and confusion that accompanies significant change at the federal level. And this is a fairly complicated act. That doesn't suggest there's a systemic problem with the exchanges,
yeah,
does it?
I would say there's three categories of issues with the exchange. The first is the kind of really small technical things that can be worked out over time that aren't really that big of a deal. There's a second category, like the issue of income verification, which does need to be fixed before subsidies go out, because then you could have a lot of problems with people's financial planning, with waste, fraud, and abuse, things like that. So that's a second category that is important to address. The third category, which gets really to the heart of your question, is are there any design flaws in the way the exchanges were set up? And I think those are considerable, and that's one of the reasons why the insurance product that's being offered on the exchange is going to be a lot more expensive than what people are used to shopping for coverage on their own.
All right, Ezekiel Emanuel, address the cost question and the other arguments that Ovik Roy made.
First of all, I think the technical glitches we're all agreed are going to be ironed out, and probably running it for a few weeks is going to be the best way to iron those glitches out. On the design, the notion of exchanges, the notion of subsidies, those are old standing notions in healthcare. They've gone back three decades. Health policy experts agree we have a very good system. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are going to be some people, where their situation is going to be worse, but for most people, it's going to be better. If some people, their rates will rise because they've had very bad coverage or they've had coverage that's excluded some key issues. The current system, the system that we've put into place, covers all preventative care for free, prenatal care, birth control pills, all cancer screening. You have no deductibles. That will raise your rates a little, but it's an important thing to get everyone involved. On balance, it's going to be much better for the vast majority of people. It'll give them choice where they haven't had choice, and it'll protect them from very high costs if they get cancer or a serious accident or things like that. That is a huge benefit to people in the country.
All right. The former Obama health care advisor, Ezekiel Emanuel, who's now at the University of Pennsylvania. Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, react to the economic argument there. Net benefit for the 300 million people who are going to be a part of this.
Yeah, so I'm one of those conservative health policy experts who does support the idea of exchanges and subsidies. It is a viable model. The question is whether or not the ACA's implementation of exchanges and subsidies is a good one. And I'd have to strongly contest Azeek's argument that only some people are going to see rate increases under the Affordable Care Act's exchanges. A study that I and my colleagues at the Manhattan Institute conducted showed that the vast majority of people under the exchanges will see increases. The people who will benefit are very poor people, people whose income is close to the poverty line, and people who are very sick who will get discounted rates. But the 90% of people who are healthy and the 75 to 80% of people whose incomes are low to middle income and above, the impact of subsidies will be too small to offset the large increase in rates that they will encounter. The underlying increase in premiums we've calculated is about 99% for men and about 62% for women. Low-income people will benefit, but that's a small number of people.
Ezekiel?
Let me give you an example of someone I just interviewed, a gardener in Los Angeles, 30 years old. His crew makes around $17,000 a year. He was quoted prices of $500 a month before the exchanges went into effect. With the exchanges, he's probably going to be able to get it for about $50 per person per month, and he can easily afford to give his crew insurance. That's the kind of difference you're going to get. These are guys making $17,000 a year.
But that's not the median income in California. That's well below. That's close to the poverty line. That's the whole point. So if your income is between 1 and 2 times the poverty line, you're going to benefit from this law, and I've stipulated that. But people
most of the uninsured are below 2 times the poverty line. That's why they can't get health care.
That's not true.
So they're going to be advantage, which was the whole point here, to get the uninsured coverage. Now, let me give you another example. I have a friend in Colorado, self-insured, works alone, got cancer. Her insurance company jacked up her rate 24%. Now, I'm pretty sure that on the exchange, she's going to be able to get a better deal because she has a pre-existing condition.
Although these are
people who are definitely going to be benefited from the exchange.
You agree that people who are sick will get a discount under this, and that's one of the advantages.
Sick, people who are sick and people who are low income will benefit. Everyone else will not.
I'm hearing, though, gentlemen, both of you say, let's just do it now, that there really isn't a huge argument for delaying this and shutting down the government. Let's do it now. Let's see what the test is and do the fix when it's time to do that, a year down the line, 2 years down the line. Ovik Roy, final thoughts?
As I said, I would support a delay to work out some of the design flaws and some of the issues around rate shock, some of the issues around income verification. Having said that, we shouldn't be talking about shutting down the government over that. And I think that the time to make that argument was last year, not this year.
Ezekiel Emanuel?
We do need to give people insurance. And from a health policy standpoint, there's no reason for delay. As we've both agreed here, both from the conservative and liberal standpoint, there is a need to work out kinks. The president agrees on that. And shutting down the government or delaying increasing the national ability to borrow, those aren't going to solve that problem. Let's solve the problem instead of talking about heated political rhetoric that has nothing to do with health care.
Ezekiel Emanuel, former Obama administration advisor on health care. He serves as the chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. And Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks for a spirited conversation, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Take care.
And that's the Takeaway podcast for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry.